This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Losing a loved one is, simply put, painful. Such separation brings extreme sadness that can feel sometimes too heavy to bear. The Irish writer C.S. Lewis chronicled his suffering and healing after his wife died of cancer at the age of 45. In A Grief Observed, he reflects, bereavement is a universal and integral part of our experience of love. The American Psychiatric Association, or APA, in its diagnostic manual, has long warned doctors away from diagnosing major depression in people who've just lost a loved one. It's known as the bereavement exclusion in the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But a proposed change in a draft of the DSM's next edition, due out next year, eliminates that bereavement exclusion, and this has posed many questions in the profession. We'd like to hear from our listeners. If you're a therapist or a psychiatrist who's treated grief, where do you draw the line between grief and depression? Share your experience. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the comedy duo of Key and Peele on race, stereotypes, humor, and their new show on Comedy Central. But first, how we treat grief. Tammy Blackard Cook is a licensed clinical social worker who provides therapy and counseling for Aspire Group in Raleigh, North Carolina. In her blog, she's also written about her own grief. Last year, her father died of lung cancer. Tammy Blackard Cook joins us now from member station WUNC in Durham. Welcome. Thanks so much.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
Can we just ask you about that first, Tammy? After treating people as a professional, treating people for grief, what did you learn when you went through a grieving process yourself?
Oh, so much. I mean, certainly I've been through grief before, but not you know, the loss of someone so close to me. You know, it's the first time I'd lost a parent or, you know, sort of that generation. Before that, it'd only been grandparents. I guess it sort of confirmed what I'd always assumed, you know, in listening with my clients and sort of hearing their experience and walking with them through their grief. You know, it's just, it's incredibly hard and it is overwhelming. And, but it is what it is. You know, you have to accept that grief is part of life and death is part of life. And, you know, I sort of, one of the things I say to my clients, and I try to follow my own advice, is you kind of have to lean into it to kind of make your way through it. But I know in America, a lot of times we just want to feel better. You know, we try to do things to avoid feeling bad. Any sort of negative emotions like grief or sadness or that kind of thing. And you know, it just doesn't work. People.
Were you more sympathetic to that, though, when you were going through it yourself in a way?
Yes and no, I guess. I guess that's why we go into being therapists. You know, I feel like I'm pretty attuned to how people feel and, you know, can really sort of, I guess in some ways, be with them and sort of hold a safe place and I think have some understanding, some, you know, and intellectual understanding, but also some other kind of understanding, if that makes sense. And so, like I said, I think it just confirmed what I always had gotten from my clients.
And did it change your treatment of others? I mean, did it change the way you deal with your clients after having gone through the death of your father?
For me, no. I can see that it really would with some other folks. And some folks I work with, I mean, we sort of talk about that sometimes. They haven't had that sort of firsthand experience with grief. But, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, to be fair, we knew that my dad would probably have a recurrence. That's just the way lung cancer is. And I think he had it for 10 years and he was fine. So I think I'd been sort of steeping myself for a long time And maybe in that 10 years, that had made me a lot more attuned with my clients who were going through something like that.
We're also joined by Dr. Michael Craig Miller. He's been a practicing psychiatrist for more than 30 years. He's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter and an assistant professor at the Harvard Medical School. And he joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can I ask you, when do you know that a patient's grief has become a major depression? Where do you draw that line?
The reality is that there is no firm line, and it is always a judgment call. Personally, I understand the debate about the bereavement exclusion, but I think our interest as clinicians is often simply to be practical, and my advice often to people who are going through this is that if you think you may be depressed, then it is probably worth having a conversation with somebody in a position to help. And again, there is a variety of needs to classify things, to categorize illnesses, but on the personal level, the labels tend not to matter as much as the practical concern that people shouldn't feel a sense of shame if they feel they need some help to get through something, to ask for it, either from a family member or from a minister or a rabbi or a primary care doctor or a therapist or a psychiatrist. And everybody's story is unique. Everybody's way of grieving is unique. And so the categories, which are interesting to debate, tend to be less important for the individual going through the loss.
Surely. But as a professional, what are there signs you look for that distinguish one from the other? Because I don't know that I could. You know, I have not had a person very close to me die. I cannot say I've gone through this kind of grief, but I'm imagining I would be hard-pressed to distinguish.
Yeah. This
despair.
You know, you're absolutely right. And this is as difficult for professionals as it is for people who aren't practicing clinicians. You know, the symptom, if you want to call them symptoms, but the description of grieving looks very much like depression. People cry, they feel depressed, they're having trouble sleeping, they may not have an appetite, they may not feel like doing anything, they may not take pleasure in anything. It goes down the list, and it looks very much like what we describe as major depression. And what professionals have done is to try to put an arbitrary time frame on it. So in the prior version, the current version of the DSM, there's a statement that it should be at least 2 months, but with those symptoms. But as many have pointed out, those symptoms can continue for 6 months, for a year, for longer. It depends on the culture. It depends upon your family. It depends upon who you are and how you manage loss. And so we use the guidelines, and I think that being practical, if you needed a cutoff, if those symptoms were going on for longer than 6 months, then you might turn to a family member and say, gee, this may be more complicated than, not that losing a parent or a spouse is ever easy, but there's a certain point where the symptoms persist and the inability to get out and go to work or live your life after a certain period of time, we have a variety of ways of trying to help people get back into their lives. And, you know, I liked what was said earlier about leaning into it, that the ultimate goal, I think, rather than getting over it, is to remake your life in a new form after somebody you've lost has been lost.
All right, let's get a call in here. Brian is in Hickory, North Carolina. Hi there, Brian.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
Well, when I heard the topic, I just thought maybe I could make this contribution. I've had about 15 years of interacting with folks as a chaplain, both in hospice and in a hospital setting, and whether someone is lost suddenly in a ER or operation gone wrong or in a hospice setting where you know the death is coming, I find that afterwards the greatest challenge is just like your speaker just said, is trying to help to empower the grieving person to reset their life and to continue to live the quote normal life that they currently have. And I see depression as, you know, if you're trying to distinguish the two, I see depression as the showing itself when someone just comes to a complete stop and is unable to do their day-to-day things and just can't take on that necessary task of creating a new life for themselves.
Whereas in your experience, people who are grieving can keep showing up at the office and all, although isn't that very individual also?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I guess, again, you know, when I heard that DSM was thinking of taking off this exception, I find that grief is absolutely normal, and it's only appropriate that a person allow the symptoms that are just a part of our humanity to show themselves in great depth. I mean, we have to cry. We have to be silent and quiet for a time. If someone just goes forward without, quote, showing the symptoms, I don't. That, to me, is mental illness. I mean, appropriate health is to stop and acknowledge that something profoundly significant has happened to you.
All right, Brian, thanks for the call. Tammy Blackard Cook, you're agreeing there.
Yeah, no, I've actually agreed with everything that's been said. Yeah, I think that I get hard-pressed to want to give anybody a diagnosis of major depressive disorder. You know, anytime under a year. I mean, I know what the DSM says, and it is an arbitrary, you know, timeline, because everything that's been said is true. You know, it is, the symptoms of depression are very, very similar to the symptoms of grief. And, you know, there are periods of time, especially early on, when people do have a hard time functioning. And so anyway, in my practice, you know, practically, which is what I liked what the doctor said, was, you know, I wouldn't necessarily diagnose someone with that early on.
All right.
It would probably wait at least a year.
And we're going to continue the conversation in a moment. We're talking about the line between grief and major depression. If you're a therapist or a psychiatrist, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or email us at talk@npr.org. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. There is an ongoing debate among psychiatrists over what constitutes normal grief and what deserves a diagnosis and treatment as major depression. The argument centers on a proposed change in a draft of the next edition of the DSM, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We're talking today not about the specifics of that debate, but about the process of grief. If you're a therapist or a psychiatrist who's treated grief, where do you draw the line between grief and major depression? Share your experience. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Tammy Blackard Cook, a licensed clinical social worker who provides therapy and counseling for Aspire Group in Raleigh, North Carolina. Also, Dr. Michael Craig Miller, a practicing psychiatrist for more than 30 years. He serves as editor-in-chief of Harvard Mental Health Letter and assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We have an email from Lalaine, who writes, who says that the grief over the loss of her mother impacted her daily life in a debilitating way for quite a time. I was offered pharmaceuticals, she writes, but I thought I was something I had to go through and did not want to mask my emotions, memories, or thoughts. I was in a fog for 4+ years. Dr. Michael Craig Miller, what about the notion that this is something that we need to go through? You know, the 7 stages, right? Isn't that what it's supposed to be?
Well, everybody has a different idea about the stages and categorizes them. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we've learned since, Dr. Kubler-Ross years ago talked about 5 stages and other people have come up with 7, that we really don't go through this in a linear way. We don't go through this in from one stage to the next without any back and forth. It can take months. It can take years. And I think what the I liked very much what the chaplain caller said earlier about this notion of being stuck or not of being stopped in your tracks.
Able to function, he talked about. How can they function?
Exactly, right. And, you know, I think that loss of this sort is inevitable. We all go through it. There's that old line about turning a crisis into an opportunity, but this is really something different, that we have to, in a way, grow with experiences like this. We learn things about ourselves. And the emailer who talks about being the keeper of memory, I think one of the reasons, one of the people who's been vocal about this bereavement exception is Dr. Arthur Kleinman, who wrote an article in The Lancet recently, where he talks about, he quotes this notion of being the keeper of the memories of the person who's lost. He lost a spouse after a long marriage. And so what the writer talks about is being sort of the keeper of the memory of her mother. Another thing that might be worth raising is that if you've been in a caregiving position with an aging parent, then it's much more complicated, because the caring for the parent, the caring for the spouse, is part of the structure of your life, and it may actually be harder to move forward in your life if not just the loss of the person, but the loss of the structure of day-to-day life, and if taking care of an aging parent has really provided you with a sense of day-to-day meaning, that's another kind of loss. So these losses are really quite textured and different, and depend so much on the circumstances.
Tammy Blackard Cook, taking that maybe as an example, can you offer others? Again, what do you look for? How do you distinguish grief and depression?
Well, the one point I wanted to raise, and I hope this answers your question, but I guess for me in my work day to day, if someone comes in and they're having a hard time, they lost someone, they're going through grief and that kind of thing, I don't always see my job as necessarily having to switch whatever diagnosis I may have given them when they walked in the door to major depressive disorder in order to say to them, hey, at some point down the road, maybe a few months, if things haven't really started to get a little bit better for them, hey, have you considered medication? Because certainly we send people to get evaluated for medication all the time. But I don't necessarily think that I have to then change their diagnosis to major depressive disorder. So I may, for an example, I may have diagnosed them with adjustment disorder with depressive symptoms, which seems more, right to me, because, grief is hard, right? Mm-hmm. And I like to give people the example. Your emailer made me think of this. It's something I tell clients a lot. Nobody wants to go on medication. Nobody does, right? And sometimes, the thing about medication, and I was reading all this stuff last night, and I found it fascinating, but the thing about most of my experience with my clients and the medication is that it doesn't make it better. It doesn't take away your grief. I mean, it makes it better, sorry, but it doesn't take away your grief. You're still very sad. You're still very caught up in it. But it just sort of takes the edge off. And Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, described it. She described it wonderfully. I actually assigned this to clients to read about being and having a she was going through a divorce. It's a different kind of grief, I guess, but saying that she felt like she was in a bottomless pit and she really resisted taking medication. And she finally took something and she said, really, all it did was give me a bottom to the pit, And so then she could kind of reach up and start clawing her way out of the pit. And I think that's a really great description of how an antidepressant will work. It's not going to make your life happy and sunny and everything's fine.
You're not going to stop grieving.
No, not at all. Yeah. And if you do, something's wrong.
I'm sorry. I would just echo exactly what Ms. Cook was saying about that. Of course, as a psychiatrist, people do sometimes ask for medication,
yeah.
But that's probably more a function of where we sit. But many people who take an antidepressant, I certainly understand that one of the goals here is to try to understand the difference between grief and depression, and we're both kind of tiptoeing around that subject.
You're not giving us a checklist.
Right, right. Well, the checklists are very limited, and I prefer to think about problem lists, and sometimes the crying and the feeling stuck and the not functioning becomes intolerable to the person. And at that point, either through psychotherapy, using a variety of techniques, trying to understand what might be at the root of being stuck, or looking at the symptoms and saying, you know, look, we can give you some relief or try to give you some relief with one or this or that. And many people who opt for the medication do say this, that it puts a floor under them. They don't feel like a different person. It's simply easier to take care of the business of life and to become reengaged. And that, of course, is the ultimate goal. I think ultimately people do better in their lives when they are able to engage. And one of the models is that, you know, the work of grief is to try to, work through or manage the giving up of the person who's lost, and to be able to reconnect to other people and other experiences in your life. And, you know, and sometimes the medication can provide a bridge. Now, there may be some people who, before the loss, may have suffered depression, which never came to light before.
So maybe it's a trigger.
Or the death has become a kind of an opportunity to get help that never was obtained before. So, you know, that's the reason that it's difficult to kind of go with a checklist and find exactly the dividing line between grief and depression, because ultimately, and I bet you Ms. Cook will agree with me, that we're in the business of trying to help people solve problems rather than give them a label. And the labels can sometimes help us organize the help, but they don't answer important questions.
Let's get another caller on the line here. Mara is in Chico, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been in a private practice for about 10 years, and I experienced my own clinical depression when I was much younger and did take antidepressants at that time and found them to be very helpful. And then I lost my mother almost 10 years ago, and I never, ever considered taking antidepressants during that time because subjectively, it felt completely different. From the outside, it might have looked the same. I was sort of catatonic. I couldn't speak. I sat on the couch and watched ridiculous movies over and over and over again. But I didn't want to anesthetize or dull my senses. I wanted to be able to really cry and wail and grieve. And I knew that, and it hit me quite hard, so that at about 3 years, this is another important point, actually. The only relief I got was in my work when I was engaging with other people. So with my own patients, I felt a great deal of relief. When I was depressed, the opposite was true. I found it very hard to be really present with my patients. Hmm. But with the, in those 3-4 years, which were the hardest with the grief, I found that was, you know, we're talking about the stuff that really matters, and I'm really thoroughly engaging with them. And just one last thing I'll say is that everybody's process is different. I'm working with a woman now whose husband died 2 years ago, and her family wanted her to go on antidepressants after about 9 months. Her doctor put her on antidepressants. She really hated it because she couldn't feel anything. So she took herself off, and she's going through her process as she goes through her process. It's a very individual thing, and I feel sort of that I have a little bit of an advantage just as your one of your experts there.
So all right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Mara.
You're welcome.
Tammy.
You know,
go right ahead.
Ridiculous movies, by the way, I think are an excellent treatment for all kinds of problems. The caller reminds me, because I never forget it. My father passed away about 10 years ago. He died of prostate cancer after about 15 years. And with several months to go, we kind of expected it. But, you know, when you expect it, it's still painful. And then a few years after that, my younger sister, I got a call one August morning from my brother to tell me that this is a sister who was a dancer and a yoga instructor and the healthiest person in our family. And I got a call from my brother saying that she had died. And it was completely unexpected and a total and utter shock. And those are very different kinds of experiences to have and exquisitely painful, each in their own way. That just underscores, you know, what the caller was saying about how every loss is different and everybody's path through it is different.
We have a an email from Vicky who writes that she works in hospice bereavement and has encountered this helpful guideline in some of the literature she's read. When a person is grieving, they have ups and downs and they're still able to experience moments of joy. When a person is depressed, there's a heaviness with very little variation and an inability to enjoy anything. Does that ring true, Tammy Blackard Cook?
Yeah, definitely. I like those last two descriptions, the caller and then this. I think I read this in one of the Arthur Kleinman articles, but he was talking about how, you know, initially, and I was trying to say this before, there isn't a whole lot of places to find joy initially after a loss. But it seems, you know, obviously you hear time heals all things, and it does. And around 6 months, it seems like there starts to be moments of joy, you know, and it just sort of builds from there. And I like that description to distinguish between, you know, someone who is truly depressed versus someone who was going through the natural process of grieving.
Right.
Can I say one other thing I was just thinking about in case it's helpful to people?
Sure thing. Let me just say one thing quickly first.
Sure.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go right ahead.
One thing that strikes me is that, you know, a lot of times folks who come in to see us, it's not only that they're grieving and that they feel really, really sad and, you know, lonely and just all sorts of things, but, you know, they're also struggling with, you know, what's wrong with me? So a lot of times someone will come in and maybe they're struggling with grief, but they don't come in until, you know, a few months down the road, and they come in because folks are tired. Well, they will say, you know, I think my friends are tired of listening to me. You know, everybody moves on with your life or moves on with their life, but your loss is still very you know, prescient all the time for you, especially in that first year. And so sometimes they come to therapy because they want to talk to somebody that they won't feel like they're burdening. And that question of what's wrong with me, you know, why do I still feel this way? Sometimes talk therapy can be, you know, so healing, because what we do is sort of say nothing. You know, we sort of create a safe place to say this is normal. We sort of normalize what they're feeling and, you know, give them some education around grief, because we don't like to feel bad.
Let's get one more call in here. Kathy in Portland, Oregon. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. Gosh, what a poignant topic for me these days. My baby died 1 year ago when I was 8 months pregnant.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And thanks. When I was discharged from the hospital, they immediately gave me a prescription for an antidepressant, which I was really shocked by, but I never took. I thought, you know, I want to feel everything. I want to go through this process. And, you know, this is horrible, but I just need to feel what's going on. And it's been a struggle. This past year has been really, really hard. But I think I finally went on antidepressants last month because it was getting to the point where I didn't even want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to, like the speaker said, I didn't want to burden anybody with my problems. I think my friends were burnt out on hearing me. You know, people kind of expected me to go on as normal, and I just really couldn't function. And, you know, there might have been a bit of undiagnosed depression before my loss. I don't know. It certainly runs in my family. So I must say that I think it's a very individual choice. I mean, my counselor was completely neutral about me going on them. You know, she said she feels like it would help me. And my primary care physician said, okay, let's have you take them for 6 months and see how you feel after 6 months. And, you know, I think I'm on a better course.
All right. Kathy, well, thank you so much for the phone call.
Thank you for listening.
And I think we're going to have to leave it there. But this has been interesting and helpful. Our guests have been Tammy Blackard Cook, a therapist for Aspire Group based in Raleigh, North Carolina. She joined us from member station WUNC in Durham. And Dr. Michael Craig Miller is a psychiatrist who's editor-in-chief of the Harvard Mental Health Letter. He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, from grief to laughter, laughing at race, stereotypes, and each other, we'll talk with the comedy team of Key and Peele. Stay with us. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.